Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution with Philip Coppens
and Kathleen McGowan.
Our discussion today will focus on the mystery of Rennes Le Château, which was at the root of books like The Da Vinci Code, but also, and especially even more so, Kathleen's own The Expected One. And we've got a very special guest today to help us dig and maybe even solve the mystery of Rennes Le Château, and that is Corian de Raaf. Corian is the webmaster of rlcresearch.com, rennes-le-chateau-research.com. And he has been together with us into digging the mystery of Rennes Le Château for a combined total of more than 50 years. So that makes us look very old, but before we start to cry all about that, Corian, welcome to the Spirit Revolution.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure and a privilege.
It's wonderful to have you with us, and I just want to echo what Philip said, that you are, for me, the premier researcher in this field right now. I love your website, and I really want to say that anyone who's not familiar with it, who's interested in the mysteries of Rennes Le Château, all of the heretical mysteries in the southwest of France, anything that has to do with the sort of basis of things like the Da Vinci Code, certainly my books, that your website, rlcresearch.com, is a fantastic source of information. There's a lot of information on the internet about it, but the one thing I know when I go to your website, Corian, is that I'm always going to get, you know, the straight dope. I'm going to get real information. I'm going to get information without an agenda, and I'm going to get something that's been really well researched and really well filtered. And that's one of the things that I think that you're so great at. You are great at sorting through the real from the artifice. And so, first of all, I just want to say thank you for the gift that you've given to all of us with your research. And I want to lead into a question, which is why Rennes Le Château? How'd you get involved with it? And what created this fascination for you?
Wow. Well, first, let me thank you, and in the meantime, try to recover from that introduction. Thank you. Thank you very much. That, you know. Rennes Le Château. Well, Rennes Le Château has been on my menu for a long time. I remember that I think it was in the early 1990s that I was on a holiday on the Isle of Malta, where I was waiting in the airport for the flight back to Europe, or, well, it is in Europe, for the flight back to the Netherlands, where I live. And I needed a book to keep me occupied. And I just grabbed the first book on the shelf, and it was Holy Blood, Holy Grail by the well-known Lincoln Bagenton Lee, which, of course, was the foundation for the book The Da Vinci Code. Well, what is it? 10 to 15 years away. And, immediately I was completely gripped by this mystery of a local priest who all of a sudden becomes wealthy, who becomes powerful, or at least that's what they say in the book. And, you know, I wanted to know all about it. And Rennes Le Château has been mesmerizing me ever since. In many ways, it's given me great joy for a long period, because there's a million things to research and it's never ending. And no, I haven't solved the mystery, and I hope no one ever will, because it will provide fun and interesting times for a lot of people in the future. But it's also been very inspirational and very remarkable for me, because in the last couple of years, I can count my dad as my fixed research partner, which has been a great journey for me. You know, I was one of these people who thought that I knew too little about my parents. So, and at some stage, you know, my dad and myself, we discovered that we shared the interest and the fascination for Rennes Le Château, and we've been doing it together ever since. So, you know, as a father and a son, it's brought us together very closely. Where, you know, I'm 38, he's in his 70s, so it's probably late in life that we're finding each other, but we are, and we do that through the common interest. So Rennes Le Château has been special in more than one fashion. The core of the mystery that has or might have, you know, anything and everything to do with the church, with history, with people's beliefs, with people's fascinations, which bring out, you know, the best and the worst in people at the same time. And that I found that endlessly fascinating and really, really wanted to get to the bottom of that and get the gist of that. And, you know, on my researches, I found that there wasn't one sole source of information that you can just tap into and which will give you a head start and which sort of summarizes what has been written in what is, I believe, today almost 1,000 books about the subject. So what I've tried on RLC Research on our website, basically where I started with a page that had a lot of links to interesting websites, it's grown into a database where I try to keep track of all the theories and all the ideas in the books and to really try to present the known facts and how they've been interpreted by people, by the various authors in the last 10 to 15 years to present that to the people. And that's our RLC Research.
You've touched upon a few things which we'll come back to, but the first thing which I think is something which we've seen time and time again is that Rana Chateau, more than other mysteries, seems to stir so deep, so many emotions in people that it almost leaves no room for a normal intellectual discussion. Emotions seem to take over this subject matter so quickly and so harshly. Have you got any explanation as to why this mystery, more than anything else, is so both contagious but also so emotional?
Wow, that's a monumental question. I think it's because it has to do with the deepest beliefs and the deepest roots of our Christian history here in Europe, which is appealing to a lot of people. And then if it gets you as far, as for you to go there and actually visit the place, you'll find out that it's incredibly magical and charismatic and you know, I find it very hard to pinpoint exactly what it is, but it is, you know, a story about a man who made a fortune, you know, which is really a flat story, but it's a bit like the American dream that we all dream of, or at least some of us, in a material sense. But at the same time, it's so much more. It's the symbolism. It's stuff we recognize, you know, from our books and from our youth and from our history lessons. And there's an interpretation there for everyone. And what I found really appealing in the chateau, and what I hear back from people, is that there's so much there to discover, and there are so many angles, there's so many lines of research that you always, it's like the Spice Girls, you know, you always find one that fits you. If you're not into scary spies, you'll be into posh spies, and Rennes Le Château is a bit like that. If you don't believe that Sonia the priest found the Ark of the Covenant, then maybe you believe that he found the body of Mary Magdalene, or maybe you believe that he found documentation that Christ had a twin or a triplet brother. So there's something there for every flavor. Emotionally, the research into the subject brings people together, and it like I said, it brings out the best and the worst of people. I mean, some of my best friends to today I've met through the research in Rennes Le Château. You know, it's put me in touch with you guys, with you Philip, with you Kathleen, with your wonderful books, with Philip's fantastic articles. But I've also learned through Rennes Le Château that people sometimes really vividly disagree, and that it's sometimes hard to reconcile our ideas, that are deeply rooted into people. And in the end, what makes you emotional is that in Rennes Le Château, for me, was the first time in my life that I was confronted with, I don't know how to phrase this politely or less bluntly or, you know, less in a Dutch fashion, but with the lies of the church. By the dogmas that we've been presented with for, 2,000 years that aren't necessarily true. Rennes Le Château gives you the clues presented on a plate that invite you to dig into this story that us, you know, I was there. I was a church, you know, a choir boy when I was young. My dad was one. We had a very religious family. All these ideas that we'd been presented with, you know, in the Bible, the dogmas, the imagery, the stuff you can, the stuff you can't do, all these things, you start to question when you enter into Rennes Le Château research because of the whole theme. And that is, and I consider myself a very rational guy, but it's brought up, you know, a lot of emotions.
I'm going to try to answer Philip's question a little bit too, and say that I agree with so much of what you're saying, that it's difficult to pinpoint why it creates this incredibly powerful emotional response. But based on something you just said, I think it's very important, this idea that it has been the catalyst for so many people questioning history, questioning what we have been given as history, questioning what we believed were our origins of faith. So I think that it becomes this catalyst for sort of exploding all these paradigms. And that's why I think it is such a powerful and emotional place for so many people. And those paradigms look different for everybody. And like you said, everyone sort of comes to their own experience. I particularly like your Spice Girls analogy. but, you know, speaking as a Ginger fan,
I could have guessed.
Brilliant. You know, I want to say too that, you know, it has also been this sort of extraordinary vortex of bringing people together. In, like you said, you know, we met there. I met Philip in Rennes Le Château. I've met some of the most important people in my life there, and I think it's because people of a certain kind of questioning spirit end up there to ask those questions. And I think we all do come together there, and we all do find that we have all of, you know, this extreme curiosity about the place in common. One of the things that Philip and I talk about a lot is that essentially there are sort of two different kinds of people who come to Rennes from our observation. And, you know, some are just really puzzle oriented. They're very cerebral. They want to solve the mystery. They want to dig through, you know, they want to dig through the parchments, and they want to look at the church, you know, and they want to photograph it and stand on their head in it and try to find all these different ways to look at the puzzle. And that's really what motivates them. They're fascinated by that whole puzzle mystery element of it. And, you know, God bless them. I'm not judging that. It's not what brought me there. I certainly went there because I cared about the history of the place. I went there for the first time in 1995 because I wanted to sort of get to the bottom of this idea that there was a mystery about Mary Magdalene, because I was working on issues of women in history. But what I got pulled into there is the extraordinary spirit of the place. For me, it's not about the cerebral mystery. It's very much about a very, very deep spiritual mystery, and this idea that people are changed when they go there. I have never met anyone who did not say they were somehow affected or transformed by their experience at Rennes Le Château. And I think that goes back to the ultimate question, which is this one of those very special places on earth? Okay, Berenger Sagnier aside and all of, you know, the 19th century mysteries, going way, way back into the history of our planet, is this, do you think that this is one of those magical power places on this planet?
Absolutely. It must be. You know, if I compare myself to your two types of people, I started off being number one. I wanted to know everything about this, wanted to solve the mystery. And, you know, of course, like all the other researchers, I was convinced that I was the first intelligent guy looking into it, and that I would add up all the pieces and lay this fantastic puzzle, you know, pick up the prize and go home. and I've learned stuff that is going completely the other way. You know, one of them is that no one can solve this on his own. I think we've all experienced, you know, including you guys, that you can't do it all by yourself. You need the information from the other person, and so it does bring you together. Where I started off on my own, and then I found myself slowly turning into you know, stereotype number two. Where I was a lot more interested in the energy of the place and learning a lot, you know, not going into the depth anymore, but going into the width of the place, learning more about the history of the church in general, but also of the region and the Celts that were there and the Visigoths that were there and the Aragonese that have a link in there, and you know, the Templars, the Knights of Malta, the Cathars, everybody who's played part there, and then there's a whole you know, different area of plots developing in front of you, but it's all fueled by this same energy. And it's the same sort of energy, I think, that Patrice Chaplin describes in her books and about Rennes Chateau. So is it a magical place? It certainly is. What I haven't figured out is whether it's, you know, Rennes-le-Bain or it's Rennes Chateau. You know, you have Rennes Chateau where you have Sonnière, you know, that built what I call, you know, the cartoon version of whatever the mystery is, and there's Rennes-le-Bain, which is the town, which is like 5-6 miles from Rennes Chateau, where I think that it was really happening, where you have this huge cromlech or stone circle in the landscape, which is, I think, a natural formation, but which is immensely powerful. And if ever I felt the energy, the emotion, it was in Rennes-le-Bain. It's been two times in my life. First time was, or the last time was in Rennes-le-Bain when my dad was ill, so I went there on my own with my fixed group of researchers and had to go home early because I had to do some business in the Netherlands. And I left really, I was going to leave like 6-7 in the morning, and then I was lying in my bed. I couldn't sleep. I had nightmares, and the place was really playing with me. And I went out, and I heard a bang, and it was, you know, the door, or, you know, the porch of the churchyard closing. It was clappering, and I was really freaked out. And normally, again, I'm a rational guy, but I was paranoid. I was looking over my shoulder, and it, you know, the place was really haunting me. I had never experienced anything like that in my life, but on the first time. And the first time was when I was 11 years old, and when I was in Chambéry in France, where I saw not even the real, but a copy of the Turin Shroud, which had been kept there for a number of years, you know, in the castle in Chambéry. And it's a funny, I just realized that place too, I was there with my dad. I went in there with my dad, 11-year-old guy. I saw this imagery of the Turin Shroud, and it made a monumental impression on me, and I passed out. So, you know, next minute I was looking at it, the other second I woke up, had banged my head into the floor, and I had no idea what had happened, but this image has been burned into my mind again, and this came back in Rennes-le-Bain. So is it a magical place? Yes, it is. But it for me personally, it must have something to do with our origins, with the roots of Christianity, and all that mixed into, well, call it a toxic mix, or call it a really potent mix of love, whatever. But for me, that's what it represents. Does that answer your question?
It does. And just to relate some personal experiences of Rennes-le-Chateau, which I had there, it's I've been going to the place for about 14 years, and it was only in last May that I actually stayed there for a period of days, living within the village itself. And one of the things which begins to strike you is, first of all, that the church bells never ring at exactly the same moment in time. Now, you know, the clock might be off by a few minutes, but then you would expect from that time differential to at least be 15, 15, 15, and 15 minutes forward, and then once again on the hour. But that's just not the case. The church bells ring at 13, 17, 16, 14, 15 minute intervals, with nothing to suggest that, you know, whatever is going on has got anything to do with what should be going on. And I remember once going into the church on the final day before I left, and it was 10:22 in the morning, and the church bells were going off like mad, and I was the only one in the church. And there was nobody else apart from a person from the local bookstore. And we were both just kind of like looking and going, what is the church bells doing here? Because nothing is happening. There's nobody, you know, being buried or anything like that. It's just one of these places whereby you do freak out, because they are places of extreme personal experience, which just shows you, I think, that when you move from a puzzle person or an armchair researcher into a person who actually goes to these places, whether it's Rennes-le-Chateau, Rennes-le-Bain, Chambéry, or any of the places, it transforms you, because no longer is it something abstract, which is purely intellectual, but it's something which you've actually living. And that kind of like is in the introduction to my next question, Corian, which is, what specific purpose do you want your website to have? Is it for you to communicate your own theories or your own observations, or is it more to the fact that people can have a proper understanding, a proper introduction, a solid foundation from where to build? And your website is rlcresearch.com.
Well, I want everybody, including myself, to have an objective source of information on this mystery. So I want them to know what really happened, from as close to the source as possible. So, you know, what did the French researchers write? What did the French researchers write in the early 1900s when the first accounts were published? What really happened there? So people can have their own interpretation. Can make, you know, I try to present all the pieces of the puzzle so people can piece them together by themselves. And at the same time, I try to give people the puzzles that other people think they've solved. So how did the French researchers lay the puzzle? What do they think happened? How did English researchers lay the puzzle? And how do they think that everything fits together? It's funny because for the last couple of months, you know, I haven't updated the site, you know, of course, because I'm busy with my music, which is getting slightly out of hand, and because I, you know, I run a business in the Netherlands, and that's where I, you know, make the money to pay my mortgage. So some attention has to go there, but it's also, but you know, the more you discover, the more you know about this mystery, you know, and that's maybe a personal thing, but the less I want to share with other people. So it's turned, you know, from a puzzle hunt, from a treasure hunt into some sort of mystical thing. So I try with RLC research, I try to inform people, and they can go this far, and after that, you know, I try to get in touch with them and share some of the mystical experience with them. So, you know, I'm the member of a small research team. We all met each other, you know, through my website or in Rare Chateau. But the best insights we had when it got personal. So, you know, in some way, RLC research, it is an introduction. It's an idiot's, well, it's not an idiot's guide to Rennes Le Château, but it's an introductory guide to Rennes Le Château, where, you know, and really, really please you recognize that, where you get unbiased information about the mystery and what people think, you know, and it's supposed to have all the ridiculous ideas as well as the sensible ideas. You know, some people think there's a UFO garage under Mount Karak. Other people have, you know, quite plausible theories that, you know, if you read them, you think, well, why not? You know, there's even a chance that is true. And some of the fun in Rennes Le Château is also to present that mix, I guess.
As I listen to you talk about how the journey has changed for you, how you started out, you know, very into the sort of cerebral puzzle aspects of the mysteries and have evolved into this place of it becoming a very personal, very mystical experience. I think that's a good segue to talk about where this has taken you in this other aspect of your life, which is your very exciting, flourishing career as a singer-songwriter, because you have found a way in this last year to take some of these mystical experiences and begin to use them in this extraordinary art form that you are pursuing and creating. And I definitely want to hear you talk a little bit about how this has informed your music and where you're going with your music right now.
Okay, well, thank you for asking. Well, I've been a musician for a long time, writing songs for a long time. You know, I'm not a brilliant piano player or, you know, brilliant instrumentalist or not a brilliant singer, but I was always writing songs because for me it's a way to deal with my emotions and with relations and stuff. Well, you know, the complicated stuff in life. I've always been looking to combine my passions into one. And then there was Book of Love, you know, written by you, which made an incredible impression on me. And, you know, I don't want to give away anything of the plot of the book, so, you know, feel free to edit this out. But in the same way that you can, you know, depict a book by building a cathedral, you can depict a book by building a song about it. So you pick certain images, you put them in an order, in a sequence, and you put on music and you sing about it. So where previously, I'd had the idea earlier to write about the mystery, to write about Rennes Le Château. You know, I did at the time that we had the Renaissance interview radio station. You know, I did the tunes, and they were sort of inspired by the mystery of Rennes Le Château. But I could never get myself to write a song about it, because I have this strange fixation in my head that every song has to be about a relation of some sort of another. And then there was the book, and then there was, you know, Kathy McGowan, who explained that, you know, relations were everything to do with this mystery, and that relations between people through the ages were exactly what it's all about, and all starting with this, you know, first mother of all relations. Well, I hate the term, but the mother of all relations between Christ and Mary Magdalene, and that tremendously inspired me. And there it was, the first song, and I remember reading the book and then, you know, really deciding to write a song. And eventually when I sat down, it was there like half an hour. It just, you know, forced itself upon me. And there was the opportunity, you know, to do something with music and the mystery. And then, you know, the next step was to write a song for the book City of Secrets by Patrice Chaplin, which, in some way, you know, initially felt like betraying the Book of Love, until I heard the responses and was really encouraged by people to go this way, make it a bit wider, but that's always been my drive, is to do something, you know, with integrity, to do something that does justice to the book. And it, you know, what started with the Book of Love has now started to become an album full of songs about books, about mysterious or mystical subjects, and it's been overwhelming. You know, the response from people. I actually sell music now, which is quite special in this day and age. But you know, more than that, it's an enormous privilege to be able to express yourself in music, and people actually taking notice of it. And because, you know, the songs are all inspired by books, people really, really listen to the lyrics and really try to filter out the message. Where, you know, if you listen to a song on the radio, it'll go la di da di da di da, and you listen to it, and some of it will stick to your mind and some won't. But, you know, in my case, people really pay attention. They look for the link between the music and the book. And for some books, like The Masonic Magician, that I wrote for Philippa Fox, an English writer, which is a book about alchemy and Count Cagliostro, you know, she reported back to me that the moment we published the single, the sales of the book notably went up. So it's really impacting each other, and it enables me as an artist, you know, to express myself in cooperation with people that write about the subject that I love. So, you know, it's a sword that cuts not both but a million ways at the same time, and it's great to be able to do that.
And I think it's the perfect introduction to actually start listening to the Book of Love. And just before we do that, we also note that the jingle of the Spirit Revolution is the opening lines of City of Secrets, also written by Corian. Corian, here is your Book of Love.
A rose gives you its beauty, but hurts you with its thorns. The symbol of unity can be too painful to hold. Like the story of the woman who loved this one man, who died for his devotion for the others in the land. Love can conquer anything, but I'm sure that you also felt the pain. When blood was washed away, the love remained, called your name. It started in her heart, the miracle, and the book that lived on after you'd gone. Mary Magdalene brought love. It cannot be extinguished, cannot be ignored, cannot be denied now, of the woman and the Lord. Symbols in the churches, parchments and the stones, the clues in all the searches will lead you straight towards.
That's The Book of Love by Corian the Wrath, which is also available, I think, Corian, from iTunes.
It is, yeah. You can do two things. You can go to iTunes and then search Corian, C-O-R-J-A-N, or go to my website, corjan.net, C-O-R-J-A-N.net.
Corian, bringing it back to the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, from a puzzle person, you have had personal experiences in Rennes Le Chateau, and you have just been highlighting how actually things like the Book of Love, but also being exposed to some of these mysteries, has transformed you as a musician. Bring it slightly back to the Rennes Le Chateau mystery. What do you think are the pitfalls? What should people be aware of not to fall into? And what are the directions where you would want to see people go into?
Wow, some clever questions. The pitfall, I guess, is to pretend that nothing ever happened. The pitfall, I think, is to go with the skeptics and to, there's a school of thought around Rennes Le Chateau who claim that, you know, Sonnier was just a fraud, really. He was into mass trafficking, so he put adverts in newspapers, and then people would send him money to say mass. And then, you know, if you put this into the historical perspective, you know, this was a practice that actually happened, and it's even worse. We're I think 100% sure that Sonnier was involved in mass trafficking. You know, he said masses for which he was paid, and he was probably paid more money than for which he said masses. Which was a common practice at the day and age. At the same time, the amount of money the man gathered over the number of years, surpassed a normal mass trafficking practice, by a factor of a million, which might, you know, of course, mean that he was just very well organized and cleverer than the rest. But that's not something that I believe, and that's also not something that the evidence supports. He tried to make a living by restoring furniture, by selling postcards of his domain. That was not what it was about. So if you then dive into the sources and start to see who sent him money, then you will start to see patterns, and it's convents. There's rich people that send him enormous amounts of money, but there's also poor people that send him enormous amounts of money. And again, there's convents. There's the convent of Chartres. There's the convent of Lourdes. And you know, you would think that the people in Chartres and the people in Lourdes were closer to God than, you know, a simple parish priest on a barren hilltop in the south of France. So there was something there, you know. Even so, you know, forget what I said. Suppose that this guy Bernier Saunier, in the 1880s, was in the practice of mass trafficking. Then why the hell would anyone in the north of France send this guy a couple of thousand francs, which was a bloody fortune at the time? Why would you send that to an unknown priest in the south of the country? Nobody knows. And you know, if any a mystery, this is it. In that sense, you know, people haven't changed between that age and our age. You know, in order for you to pay money to someone, someone will deliver you back a service, and it will need to be a bespoke service. And maybe if you've made a name as a priest saying masses, then you'll pay more for someone than to an unknown priest. But there's nothing to indicate, nothing whatsoever, that Saunier was famous in his day and age for saying masses. The contrary, you know, the masses that we know that he did were very controversial and even led to him being suspended by his own bishop. So pitfall, you know, don't believe that he was just a fraud. If he was a fraud, he might have been a grave robber. You know, the guy was seen in the middle of the night overturning the churchyard. You know, digging 11 feet deep holes, disappearing into them and out of them again. So he might have been an ordinary grave robber, but he certainly wasn't you know a mass trafficker. So if we need to research anything, it is probably why. Did people pay him money? And then, you know, another trajectory or another line of research that I'm, you know, personally particularly interested in is there a connection to any, Marian apparitions, apparitions of the Virgin Mary? We know that Saunier was a legitimist. So that means that he was someone that really supported the church. He was someone that was a very fierce anti-republican. I believe that the devil, Asmodeus, that's sitting at the entrance of church in Rennes-le-Château, is just a personification of one of his sermons, in which he says, you know, I can't remember the exact text, but if you go on my website, you'll see that the presentation there of Asmodeus kneeling. With the baptismal font on his head and the angels on top of it making the crucifix is a 100% image, a 100% personification of the sermon that got him suspended by the bishop. So it's a practical joke by him. How did I get there? The Marian apparitions might well have been instated, and again, that's a personal line of thought or personal interpretation by the legitimist movement. You know, people had to get back to God. People had to get back to the church. People had to get back to the king. And in order to do that, perhaps, you know, and I'm speaking hypothetically here, a number of Virgin Mary apparitions were arranged for poor farm girls, or for people that were illiterate. You know, they always happen to a poor someone in a convent who comes from a poor farming family, for a young kid in the field. Maybe there's a pattern there. Then again, you know, if you start researching these apparitions, you find out that there are really things that you count that up. So it's always ambivalent, as with everything in this mystery, but. You know, to cut it short, that is a line of research I would really, really see in a bit more depth. So, you know, if only I had the time, was Saunier involved in perhaps evoking Marian apparitions for people, and was Rennes Chateau, you know, as a place, as a magical place, as a place of spiritual energy, material in that process? And did Sonnier function, you know, as a priest, as a thought, or was it a lot more? Was it as a medium, or as a, you know, someone that was channeling the energy? You know, all these, there's so many questions, something like that.
One of the things we were discussing was that how in his own lifetime he had already a series of photographs which he wanted to show to or sell to visitors to, who were coming to Rennes Chateau. This attraction of Rennes Chateau, what kind of, when you go there, what kind of personal experience does it leave upon you? And has it changed over time? Because I can definitely imagine that when I was there in 1995 for the first time, the first thing I wanted to do was get out. It really had a very uncomfortable atmosphere. And over time, it began to change. And in over the past 2 to 3 years, it actually became a place where I would like to actually spend more than 15 minutes. Which is, as we know, the minimum time in which you can run through the village and see everything as fast as you can.
Yeah.
Have you felt that own transformation? And because you went there for the first time in 1995 as well, and is it something which other people have had? And what kind of what is your personal experience with the village?
My personal experience with Rennes Chateau has always been great. You know, I loved it from the first minute I was there, and I still do. You know, I long for the place. When I go back to the place every year, every month, every day, every hour, I strongly feel that I belong in the region. And I had that feeling, you know, from the first second I set foot there. I can still remember that. You know, we were staying close by in a village, and I was driving up to Rennes Chateau with my girlfriend for the first time, and I can still, you know, in Technicolor. Imagine how I got around the bend and first, you know, laid eye on the Tour Magdala. So it's been fantastic for me. And also, you know, the church, it's never frightened me. It's always inspired me, and it's always, you know, given me energy and given me, you know, a lot of energy. And the same, it, same for my dad, and same, for example, for my son. I took my son there, I think, 2 years ago, and he, at the time, he was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, and he was just, you know, standing opposite, you know, the devil Asmodeus, and we were really scared that he was going to have nightmares and everything from it. And, you know, up front, we've been talking to each other, shall we let him into the church, or shan't we? Because, you know, it might make too big of an impression on him, and you know, he might not like it, he might be scared, but he loved it, and he was intrigued, and I could feel that he had the same thing that I did. But then again, other people, you know, the people from the research group that I'm in, or friends that have been there, they you know, almost without an exception, they have reported that you know, their photo camera stopped function around the church and around the chateau. Their phones didn't work anymore, or started ringing all of a sudden. They got text messages that meant nothing. Those sort of things. But me personally, I just loved it. You know, and in the last, I must say, the last years when I come there, there's a certain sadness about the place. But that, I, you know, for me, that is everything to do with the state of the domain at present, which, thank God, that they're now, you know, trying to restore to its old splendor. But it's been very bad for a long time, and you can now literally, you know, see the stone crumble from the church and from the Tour Magdala, from the great, you know, the fresco in the church that is literally falling apart, which is awful. And, you know, for me, you know, with the number of visitors there and with international renown that it's got, it's almost unbelievable that the French government never made it, you know, a historical monument site, which makes you think, doesn't it?
It definitely does. And I think we're coming to the end of our show, but I want to have like one final gut instinct reaction. And you were hinting at it before, which was the fact that you feel that Rennes Le Château and the intrigue of the town, if not the priest, Baron Gessonnier, has got to do with the fact that it's the origins of Christianity. But then a few minutes ago, you were saying, well, in the pitfalls that he might be selling masses. So what kind of, how do the two compare, and what is your good instinct as to why, what's going on with the origins of Christianity and Rennes Le Château?
Sonnier was a scoundrel, but he was overtaken by the place. You know, I truly believe that, you know, the Grail is in everybody, the Grail is in everyone, the Grail is in every relation, and it's probably something different for everyone. And Rennes Le Château, you know, as a place, as a place of energy, as, you know, I don't believe in UFOs, and basically I don't believe in portals, channeling, or, you know, going into fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh dimensions. But I can't deny what I felt, and I can't deny what I see, and I can't deny what happens to people there. And again, bringing the best and the worst up in people. I think Sonnier, in his heart, you know, was a typical priest from the time. You know, someone with a bit of education and that had a, you know, hierarchically superior position to the village that he was a priest in, and exploited that position. And he did that to the best or the worst of his abilities, and I think, to his own surprise, ended up, you know, in some sort of a spiritual conspiracy or something that was far larger than him, and which eventually, I think, killed him. You know, not literally, but because I don't think he could grasp or process what had happened to him and what he actually found.
And so the question remains, kind of like, what is the mystery of Rennes Le Château and the origins of Christianity?
Well, the mystery of Rennes Le Château, to me, is not how Sonnier got rich, but it's very much what were they doing, and why. Again, it boils down to what I said earlier. Why would people send money to the place? I mean, that is the most tangible thing that can't be explained, and I'm sure that the answer to that question somehow relates to the mystery of Rennes Le Château. Now, about the roots of Christianity, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, there's been temples in the area that, you know, like we probably all know, that did their, you know, they're digging on in Jerusalem at the time of the Crusades, and that might well have brought stuff back to the area that might well, you know, have implications for what we think are the dogmas of the church or something like that. And that chance, I think, is very big. But we but if it comes together, you know, if that is true, and, you know, if it's true that people in history, or, you know, maybe 500 or 1,000 years ago, and exactly like Kathleen describes, if people were more in touch with nature at the time, if people were more inclined to feel the presence of special energies in places, you know, then if there was any place that the Templars or the Cathars or whatever group would bring their most holy relics, their most holy stuff to, it might well have been Rennes Le Château. But how it fits together exactly, I don't know. And, you know, and today it's less important for me than it was a couple of years ago. You know, I found my Grail. I found friendship. I found love. I found great, you know, great ideas, and a whole lot of joy. You know, that gives me great energy in life. And what else can I wish for?
I can't think of a more beautiful and perfect way to end this interview than with those closing words of yours. And I agree. I also found the Grail in Rennes Le Chateau. and so I wish that same sort of beautiful discovery to everyone else who is involved in these mysteries. Corian, thank you so much for everything that you give us with your extraordinary research and your beautiful music. It has been a pleasure to know you and continue to get to know you and your work, and blessings on your path, and I so look forward to encountering you again many, many times on this journey.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure.
That was Corian de Raaf, the webmaster of rlcresearch.com, one of the principal sites to do with the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau.
I think one of the things you have to love about the Rennes Le Chateau mystery is that it really is the gift that keeps on giving. It never gets old. There's never any agreement on it. And as I'm listening to Corian, who I respect so much, and I'm listening to his analysis of what Berenger Saunier was and what he did and his assessment that Saunier is a scoundrel, I'm thinking to myself, I absolutely have a different point of view on that. And that's what I think is so exciting about this issue. It's sort of a, you know, vive la difference. I mean, there are so many angles to take this mystery. I mean, I think for me, the root of it becomes in terms of Saunier's story. I just don't believe that anything about Saunier or that mystery happened as an accident. I don't think this man accidentally found himself in this village. I don't think he was anybody's just average village curé. I think that all of this was a very, very large conspiratorial effort. I think that he was created for this role. I think he was groomed for it from the time he was a child. I think that there were so many layers of issue, and you know, I'm using that conspiracy word again, but I think that it's the quickest way to get to the heart of it for a 21st century office. There's so much going on in Rennes Le Chateau long before Saunier ever gets there that none of it can be an accident. And so for me, looking at it from that point of view, the rest of these ideas that, oh, he's selling masses and, oh, he's making money this way, none of that works for me. For me, all of that trivializes the importance of this place and why it continues to be so important to this day. There's something much bigger going on here.
And I think it highlights a basic problem, which is far larger than the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, which is that the objective evidence that it is so often called is the fact that Saunier got money from somewhere and that some of these people have been identified. And then the scientific, if you want, approach is always to be the skeptical approach. But that is also quite often a pessimistic approach, and it's quite often the one which is the furthest from the truth, because very few people, the majority of us, actually do and live through life without this pessimistic approach. We do things, we accumulate wealth, we buy cars for our enjoyment. It's one of these things whereby the scientific approach is quite often too conservative, and the evidence goes somewhere, but there should be a further extrapolation, I think, which kind of like encompasses the truth rather than just the evidence.
Well, again, you know, look, the one thing that we know is factual is that Saunier had all this contact with very, very important people in European society. He is interacting with essentially the nobility and even the royalty of Europe. This is not something that a backwater priest does, okay? And he's not doing this because he's selling masses to the Habsburgs. You know, that just doesn't make any sense to me. There is, again, there is something bigger happening here, and something with which I think has a very, very lengthy and rich history in that part of France that goes back 1800 years. And I think that Saunier is just one in a very, very long line of people who are a part of that very powerful secret tradition. So that's what I you know, that's my wrap up. My wrap up is there's still so much more to this story that we have only begun to understand. And I want to thank Corian again for the, you know, earnest and sincere and honest research that he has given to the world. RLCresearch.com, really objective. It's one of those websites that once I find myself on there, I can't get out. I'm there for hours because there's so much much to read and look at, and each thing takes you, you know, to another part of the mystery. So do yourself a favor, check out Corian's website and immerse yourself into this really fun mystery, which, as I said, just keeps on giving. It just gets better.
And we will be giving more next week when we return with another edition of The Spirit Revolution. But until then, this is Philip Coppens and
Kathleen McGowan.
TheSpiritRevolution.com is our website for this show in archived format or any of our previous ones. Go to www.thespiritrevolution.com. Until next week.
The truth against the world.